This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's Metal Shop here on The Rock. Right now, I have a band called Training for Utopia. Now, this band is reuniting for a show at El Corazon. They're going to be playing Friday, September 15th alongside Eris. Just saw Eris live with two guitarists. Wow. Incredible, incredible sound. Training for Utopia is back, and I got Don and Ryan Brothers, the Brothers Clark from Training for Utopia. You might know them from Demon Hunter. Guys, welcome back to Metal Shop.
Thanks for having us.
So, we were just recalling off air. Let's do this on air. The reason for Training Utopia to come back, other than, you know, people want to hear it and people want to see this band again. You know, how did this happen?
Yeah, I was kind of explaining. Demon Hunter played Furnace Fest last year.
Yeah.
And that was the first time we'd ever played that. And, you know, Furnace Fest is sort of known for reuniting bands and kind of doing these, bringing bands up from the dead, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we'd always kind of known that it might be, you know, an ask at some point if we wanted to get back together. Yeah. Or, if, you know, my band Focal Point, that even predates Training for Utopia, you know. Kind of in the air, and so to speak, and so we knew that it was potentially going to happen. Chad, one of the guys who runs the festival, is a good friend of ours, known him for a long time, and so he sort of put the bug in our ear when we were there. And Don and his son Cash were at Furnace Fest with us last year, and mm-hmm. I didn't think Don would want to do it because Don hasn't played guitar really since he left Demon Hunter in 2008, and he didn't think I wanted to do it because he thought I'm assuming my focus was like sort of singularly Demon Hunter totally. Music, you know? And so each of us kind of thought that the other one didn't want to do it. And we actually verbalized to each other and we're, you know, I'll do it. So that's kind of what got us to the next step, which was reaching out to the other guys, Morley and Steve, the rhythm section. Those guys still live in the Sacramento area where we're from. And we had not talked or seen them in 21 years. I think the last time we saw either of them would have been my wedding, which was 21 years ago. So we had to track those guys down via some mutual friends that we kind of still keep in contact with, and then set up a Zoom call. And we had no idea if they would be into it, if they would want to do it, like how long it had been since they played. And we just got together on a Zoom call, and turns out they're both stoked about the idea and wanted to do it. It had definitely been a while since they played, but, you know, they were up for the challenge. And so we did a couple of just impromptu, Zooms, and then we've been texting and stuff. And in early June, we had them up here and did our first like official practice in 23 years. So
how was that? How did that feel?
It was better than I think we expected it to be.
Surprisingly, like we had not, you know, like Ryan said, we had not played in over 21 years, and Morley, the drummer, had not played drums, what, like 12
years.
Wow.
Yeah, and it went way better than I actually anticipated. I thought it would be just an absolute mess. And, the drum parts came back from Morley pretty well.
Cool.
It felt amazing. You know, like it, just like no time had passed almost. And it was super cool. And yeah, we practiced for like 3 days.
By the end of the third day, we made it through. We stumbled through the whole set without, having to stop a song, so we made it. And then we're going to have them back up here the week prior to these shows and just really cram, for this show. And then we're playing 2 days after the El Corazon show, we're playing the Hawthorne down in Portland.
Awesome.
On Sunday night. And then that next week, we'll sort of make our way down to Birmingham and and play Furnace Fest. But that's all that's on the docket right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, bringing this thing back from the dead also has us just like, you know, what could we do? With, yeah. You know, could, yeah. we, could we do a little band, bit more of this? Or
what would the band sound like, you know, 25 years later or whatever? Yeah. It's been kind of, it's been cool to kind of like, you know, mess around with that idea, basically.
I mean, the style of music that you guys played was, I mean, ahead of its time, I would say. There's a lot of bands that are kind of doing that thing now. That style of music and hardcore is bigger than it's ever been, ever. You know, you have bands like Turnstile blowing up and going all over alternative, and you guys were, you know, I mean, Botch is back, you know, those kind of style, you know what I mean? So it's like, there's definitely, I'm assuming when this was announced, you guys probably got some texts from some old friends. Yo,
yeah,
what's
totally,
up?
Totally.
Well, it's like that 20, 30, you know, 20, 25, 30 year mark where it's like that, you know, the nostalgia, you know, also just like as, you know, older guys, just like the whole dad, you know, I told my friend the other day, I was like, this is better than buying a Corvette, dude.
Yes. Yes.
Midlife crisis stuff. But it is really cool. And, you know, like you said, like we were just huge fans of Coalesce and Today Is the Day and Neurosis. And we were just, you know, we were just kids just messing around. And it was, you know, when you put it on, it's like you can't even hear the drums because the mix is so terrible.
Sure.
But it's just like, it's just a wall of sound. And then you know, bands that were into us, were able to like do polished versions of it and got huge. And it's been cool, for sure. And we, you know, Ryan and I started a band, in 2000 that, you know, was a success and like, totally like creatively fulfilled, you know, as far as I'm concerned, when we did Demon Hunter, it was such a great thing, for us to start. So yeah. All that to say, like, I feel like now is the time, like it's the right time. Mm-hmm, like I feel like it wouldn't have been right 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all working out.
That's amazing. So let's get a time, like let's play the time game here. Basically, like I need to know. So Training for Utopia was never a Seattle band, right? Were you guys a Sacramento?
Yeah.
Sacramento,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And so you guys moved up to Seattle after Training for Utopia.
Yeah, so I think our last few shows, it was kind of a weird ending of the band, and not a very, like, definitive ending either. Mm-hmm. It was just, Don had recently, towards the end of Training for Utopia, Don had gotten married and moved to Arizona to live with his new wife.
Yeah.
And at that time, TFU wanted to keep going, so we actually did a handful of shows as a three-piece.
Okay.
Because I was playing guitar at that point. When the band started, I didn't play guitar. I just sang. And then pretty soon after that, I started playing guitar. So that gave us the ability to be able to play as a three-piece. But we did a show with Neurosis.
Awesome.
Just as a three-piece. I think that might have been one of our last shows. And then shortly after that, my brother moves back with his wife to Sacramento area. And then shortly after that, he's like, I'm moving to Seattle. Design job. Do you want to go with me? And I said, yes. And so sort of on a whim, we moved up here. And we, you know, we had talked to the guys. And I think everyone was sort of same point and just kind of like cool with moving on. And there wasn't a big discussion about it.
Nothing dramatic
because it had gone from like the four piece to the three piece to kind of like volatile. I think it was already feeling like it was kind of falling apart.
Sure.
And so it wasn't like a surprise to us. And then, yeah, like Don said, we moved up to here and then started Demon Hunter like a year later. And then that was just all encompassed, you know, for the last 20 something years for me, it's just been, you know, always happening. And so again, it's just it feels like the right time to bring this back just because Demon Hunter's well established. Like it's a beautiful thing because I can sort of pick that up whenever I want to and kind of set it down when I want to do something else. And I've done that, whether it's for work or for, you know, a side band or something like that. And it's ended up working out. So this is just another version of that where, you know, some things it feels like are better left in the past for a long time, and then it sort of comes full circle, and you're like, this would actually be really cool to do, and you kind of gain a new perspective and new appreciation for it. At that time when we were doing Training for Utopia, that sort of noisy noisecore thing that Don, like Don said, Coalesce and bands like that were doing, it was relatively new, but it seems like in hindsight it was a bit more of a novelty in terms of our tastes. Like we almost kind of grew out of it when we started doing Demon Hunter, because that sort of sound, like the really polished like 90s Roadrunner metal sound, was something that we wanted to do for a long time and something that we knew would we would continue to want to do for a long time.
Yeah.
So that's what Demon Hunter sort of fulfilled for us. And going back to the Training for Utopia stuff now is actually like feels really cool because it's something that we haven't really touched in a long time.
Yeah.
And that sort of moment in time that that existed back then, I mean, we were just slopping stuff together. And neither of us are good guitar players. We were just making do with what we had. And so it's a lot of fun to dust off all that old stuff and just like, you know, remember parts of it. Totally don't remember other parts of it.
Sure.
But just kind of cobble it together.
But I think even when we were talking about starting this back up, we all said to each other, like, this, we all want this to sound, we want to sound better than we ever have. 20 some, and we do. Like, I, you know, I,
that's awesome.
We can all, I think, play better and it sounds better. So yeah, I'm like excited to play. I'm excited to see what fans think. And,
we were always an absolute mess. Yeah. Like our shows in the 90s, it was just, we were not prepared. We were, you know, we would break a string and just like sit there and fix it between songs.
Yeah.
Very, very punk. And we would play songs like 200% the speed of what they are on the record. I think we thought that was cool, but what it really was like, it just made them into this unlistenable mash.
But that was just so part of the package, though.
It totally was, to the extent that when we did like a little, you know, best of kind of compilation at the end of the band's run, we called it Technical Difficulties because the band was just wrought with technical difficulties, whether it was an amp blowing up or, you know, forgetting songs, or just, it was just a mess.
But now
we have the chance to like write for the first time. Like, we've been playing.
You've got the pro gear.
Yeah, we've got the pro gear. I've been in a professional band for a long time.
We've got like the DH pedigree as like a template. You know, like Ryan, you know, has all these bells and whistles now that we can actually use at our disposal.
Yeah.
I was just thinking how TFU, you know, we would mostly like on the floor, on the ground, on the floor.
Yeah, which
we
is
rarely
which is
were
my
on
favorite.
A stage.
I love, exactly.
Which made it like when we talk about being just like a mess and just sweat everywhere and strings broken, it was like that was part of the joy.
Oh, totally.
Of it all, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
and
we're
I mean,
all right there.
A lot of it was by design. You know, some of it was just like that we weren't good musicians and we didn't have good gear and stuff. But the other half was that we were chaotic by design and we would, you know, I would jump head first into the drum set and I would grab my guitar with both hands by the strings and just try to shake my guitar off of the strings, you know?
A buddy of mine, like an old friend of mine the other day was like, yeah, with TFU, didn't you guys, I had heard one time that you guys just take all your riff ideas and smash them into like a song. I was like, yeah, that's pretty much right. But there was no like, you know, there wasn't
tempo,
a whole like, not a whole lot of method, just
no.
Kind of like what sounds the craziest, off tempo stuff. If we're going fast, let's go slow right afterwards. Like,
you know. And we were, you know, we were fans of Coalesce and Converge and all these bands that were leaps and bounds more talented than we were. And so we were sort of kind of trying to emulate what they were doing with this weird off-time stuff.
Sure.
We couldn't really fully
grasp
how to do that, like, in a really cool way, like bands like Meshuggah or Coalesce do, you know? And so what you hear is, like, us trying to do that and sort of making it maybe, like, an eighth of the way.
Yeah.
You know, so there's, like, couple of sections.
We got a record deal out of it.
So. We did.
There you go.
There's a few sections that are, like, maybe 5-4 or something like that. Or, or the...
On accident.
You know, the compositions are kind of odd for songs. But most of the time, it's just, like, 4-4 stuff played really fast and sloppy.
Nice.
You know.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to pause for a second. Well, this interview, and we're going to jump into a song from Training for Utopia. Again, they're playing at El Corazon with Eris on Friday, September 15th. Tickets are available now. They're also going to be playing Furnace Fest down in Alabama. So going to be pretty awesome. We're going to play The Falling Cycle. Who wants to tell me about The Falling Cycle? This was an earlier song of you guys, right?
Yeah, this was the first EP. So at the time, I was in a band called Focal Point.
Yep.
And my brother had started Training for Utopia with a different singer. I don't know how many people know that, but the first iteration of the band was with a guy named Rob Dendler. And Rob and my brother kind of formed this band while I was busy with Focal Point. Focal Point gets off the road in 1997 in the summer. And I could quickly tell that Focal Point was kind of fizzling. Mm-hmm. The tour we went on was sort of a trial by fire. We were, you know, 18 years old. We went all the way across the country. And so Rob was leaving to go back to LA where he was from. And so there was a hole to fill in Training. And I would, my tastes and sort of what I wanted to do, Training for Utopia was a lot more, at the time, was a lot more what I wanted to do. I had written lyrics for Focal Point. You know, I played guitar in that band.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd sort of been real hands-on with the vocals and background vocals, writing the lyrics, all that stuff. So I knew that I wanted to be a frontman, wanted to be a singer.
Yeah.
And so Training for Utopia gave me that first opportunity to do that. And as soon as I joined, I would say probably a couple months later, we went and recorded an EP, which at the time we called Breathing in Disease.
It was just a demo.
It was a demo. We put it on a cassette.
Nice.
We recorded it with Eric Stenman at a studio called Enharmonic in Sacramento, which is like it's a famous studio there. Deftones, I think, did Adrenaline there.
Nice.
We sent that cassette to Brandon Ebel at Tooth and Nail because I already had that relationship. And he was like, I love it. I want to put it out. And so I don't know why we decided to change the name of the EP to The Falling Cycle. We named it after a song. I think that probably made more sense. But we did the 7-inch and a CD version in late 97 or early
98?
97. Yeah. Okay. So it was all happening super fast.
Yeah.
Like Focal Point's fizzling. I joined this band. Like we do a demo. I took some of Rob's lyrics for three of the four songs and adapted them in my own way. And then I wrote the lyrics to a song on my own. So it was kind of the end of that era and the beginning of a new one.
Yeah.
Actually, what were Rob Dendler's lyrics? So,
okay. Yeah. Interesting. I like this backstory. So again, Training for Utopia, we're going to go into it. It's a Falling Cycle here on Metal Shop.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That was A Falling Cycle by Training for Utopia. You can see them in the flesh again back Friday, September 15th with Eris at El Corazon. This will be the first show in
23 years because I think we played right up to the end of 99.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. So Ryan, we've gone, you know, into some of your incredible visual art in past Demon Hunter interviews. Don, were you a visual artist as well that kind of influenced Ryan? Is that the story or?
I don't think I influenced. Ryan's an amazing, talented artist on his own. But like we're thick as thieves in all things music and art. Yeah, and I'm still a visual artist. I'm a illustrator, graphic designer. And,
awesome.
Yeah, I want to be a musician. But yeah, that's kind of a crazy story there too is I just started doing 7-inch art for bands coming through town.
Yeah.
I didn't do posters, but I don't know if you remember Life Sentence Records by
Yes. Time.
Okay, so
Ryan, Life Sentence X.
Yes,
right?
You got it. I did that logo.
You're the older brother, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm 4 years older.
Okay.
Yep. So he started designing considerably before I did. I didn't start professionally designing or really knowing what to do on a computer at all until late 2000, after we'd moved up here, and I sort of got an internship at Tooth & Nail.
But awesome.
He was doing, you know, he did the Focal Point art like in 96 or might have even been 95.
Is this on Quark?
Dude, yes, on Quark. And I would go to Kinko's. I didn't have a scanner. I'd go to Kinko's and scan everything I was doing. I put all the photos or images that I tore out of National Geographic or whatever put it on the flatbed scanner, scanned it all in at 72 DPI.
Okay.
So just high quality. And then it's funny, the very first Focal Point 7-inch is all pixelated, mm-hmm. but it's like kind of looks crappy, like almost like we did it on purpose, but it was not.
That's what you tell people.
Exactly.
It's supposed to look like
exactly.
that.
And then Dan Gump, owner of Life Sentence, who signed Focal Point, wanted to start using me for a bunch of different stuff, and so I did. And he would pay me in zip drives and 7-inches. So he would, you know.
Yeah, so Don would do, he would either do the full, like, 7-inch design, or Dan would just have him sort of lay out pre-existing artwork.
Yeah.
So, like, with bands like Clear or Lifeless, they sent him, like, the cover and the logo or whatever, and he would put it all together.
But it was, like, looking back, it was so, you know, I was thrown into the fire, and I, you know, like, I didn't know what I was doing, and it was kind of school for me, and I was, like, you know, having the time of my life working on artwork for these bands that I mm-hmm. loved or whatever, and then Brandon Ebel, once the Focal Point got signed, started hiring me, and I did the Focal. I laid out the Focal Point record here in Seattle. He flew me up, and I used Quark Express, and you know, Ryan, who was the painter that did Focal Point?
Mark.
He did No Effects.
Yeah, he did Heavy Petting Zoo. Yeah. He did a handful of records back in the day, but the one that always comes to mind is that Heavy Petting Zoo cover.
Mm-hmm. But that was the Focal Point record was the start of like my 23-year career in the arts. I mean, in terms of a larger audience, you know, Tooth & Nail was much bigger than Life Sentence. And then if you fast forward to 2000, when we moved up here, I had basically Brandon and myself and my partner Dimitri at the time signed like a year contract to work on a bunch of different records for Tooth & Nail. So that was
kind of the in-house
designers.
That was
the catalyst. Yeah, and Ryan was cool. Ryan was actually in-house, and we rented space from Tooth & Nail and got a lot of work from Tooth & Nail. But it was it was just a bunch of friends. Ryan was getting paid by Tooth & Nail. We were getting paid as freelancers.
Yeah.
There was so much, like that was the heyday in terms of, digital hadn't come and taken mm-hmm. over yet. So like records were still really selling. And so there was still money to be had. Budgets were bigger. And just the sheer volume of bands that we were putting out.
Yeah.
There were so many that me and whoever else would be in the art department at the time, because usually it was a two-person in-house art department, couldn't cover everything that needed to be done.
Yeah.
So Don and the other guys that he worked with were basically picking up all the slack. And so mm-hmm. we were kind of splitting the workload between what was Asterisk Studio, Don's company mm-hmm. back then, and then the in-house art department, because there was just a ton of it.
I mean, and you know, I always call that era like the MTV2 era, because we were just, we were doing records for so many bands
mm-hmm.
In that same scene. Like, you know, you name it. Pierce the Veil, For Sleep, Poison the Well, like, you know, we were doing these bands for Tooth & Nail, and then those other bands would see, you know, the art and then call us. And for 5 years straight, the phone basically rang off the hook, and we were just knee-deep in albums, and we were having the time of our life. It was
so the metalcore machine.
Metalcore machine,
churning.
Yes. And then and then it all kind of, like, culminated with Foo Fighters in 2006.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then
everything up to
then
that
came Alice in Chains, and, you know. Yeah. It was when I was actually at home. I had a newborn at the time, mm-hmm. and I got the call. Actually, Cash might have been born really, really young, but I got the call to do the Foo Fighters at home, and I was like dancing around the house. My wife's like, "Oh my gosh!" It was just like, you know,
you made it.
Yeah. Totally. We've done all these.
I mean, everything up
bands.
Until that was small little hardcore bands, and then it was Foo Fighters, and then
it was crazy. It was really, really cool.
Changed.
And Ryan and I flew down and met with Dave and the band, and it was We could go on and on with stories, but
I love that though, because it's exactly how you look at so much of media, artists, people, writers. A lot of people have their roots in punk rock and hardcore and metal. Does it teach? Fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. DIY.
Totally.
Just do it.
Yeah. I've
just
talked about that a lot lately. Yeah. We have a lot of, we, now that we sort of have segued from doing, hardcore album packages to doing corporate branding and stuff like that, we work with a lot of really big companies, Lego, Target, Nickelodeon.
I saw your Target
NASA,
stuff.
Yeah. And there are hardcore guys at all these companies.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes all the sense in the world because it was such a, don't sit around and wait for someone to ask, it was that DIY ethic where it's like, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask permission. I'm not going to let.
Wait, why isn't this being done? I'm just going to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Things like budget doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Like you're going to make it happen. Things like time doesn't matter. You're going to find the time. Like those are the sort of hardcore ethos that like dudes like that had back in the day. And so it's no wonder at all that they're, just flooded throughout every industry, you know?
Yeah. And it also that, back then we were young, we didn't have mortgages and stuff. And so it was like the perfect time to hustle and just do it for the love of it and grind. And like there was hardly any responsibility. And the things that we would do back then, we would never do now. We would get a budget to do an album and we'd spend every cent on photography.
Yeah.
And then, we make zero, but the record looks dope.
It looked great. And then we started getting calls from everyone because it looked so great. So we had the foresight to know that if you kill it and you put everything into it, regardless of how much you make, like it could become a calling card. It could get you work and it could snowball into like much, much more.
But it's also, when Ryan's talked about this too, and I as well, but this healthy obsession of like, there's no plan B. This is, we've done conferences and I speak at companies to their creative departments. And sometimes someone will come up and be like, especially at conferences, like, I love art. I don't exactly know where to start. And a lot of, my mind is thinking, well, you're asking kind of the wrong, like if you're asking that question, I don't know if it's going to work for you because there needs to be like, I'm going to do it no matter what. I already know the names of all the people who do what I love because I've researched the heck out of them.
Yep.
I'm already obsessed with them. I'm obsessed with the people those people are inspired by. Like, so you're going to make it no matter what because you just have, like I said, this healthy obsession. And that's how we were. It never once felt like work. It was always just like, we're having the time of our life, hanging out with our friends.
And it never felt like a risk either, which, I mean, a lot of it probably was. But I feel like if you risk with that sort of passion and like foresight and just like willing it into existence, I feel like the risk is lot less,
Yeah.
It's going to sound super cheesy, but I will say, just upon this reflection and hearing you guys talk, it's just how beautiful of a thing is it that this band that you started, and these, obscene demos, and all these like 7 inches that you were obsessed with as kids has now afforded you this lifestyle of being artists and doing it yourselves as, adults. And now you are covered in tattoos and, you're speaking to, high up clients at Target and Lego. And it's like, and it all stems from
it's
underground.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very powerful, powerful thing. And I honestly think that, like I was sort of saying, hardcore is very unique in that way.
Oh, yeah.
There are lots of different music scenes that someone could get into growing up, and a lot of them probably wouldn't really do much for you.
Yep.
But hardcore is sort of like, it's sort of a testing ground for the rest of your life, and it's like a trial by fire for the rest of your life where you have an awesome community of people.
Yep.
Back then, you had to sort of search for it, so you had to do a little bit of work, which
no
is,
internet,
it wasn't readily available, so it taught you to just be scrappy and like, I'm going to find these people, I'm going to find these records,
And how many like hardcore guys do we know? Now,
a lot, totally.
You know, I was talking about the other day how when we would go book our tour or TFU, our first tour, you know, there is obviously no internet. And there was like this black book of like, okay, here's the hardcore guys or gals in the cities. Here's their phone numbers. Yep. And if you want to play in their city, call them. They'll set you up. So that's what we had. I got it from someone who got it from someone else who got it from someone else. And I had this list and I booked our first tour and it was like, hey, you know, Sarah lives in Charlottesville. Yeah. Or, you know, it's just like, it's so random.
It was like, you got to go see Igby down in Southern California.
Yeah, it was like this.
Like, Francisco owns Chapter Records. You like, you know, these names that just sort of exist.
The secret
out there
club and, like, type thing. Yeah.
I remember seeing Maximum Rock and Roll had something called Book Your Own Thing Live, right? Yep. And that was kind of, so.
Yeah, that's right. That was similar. That had all the numbers and stuff.
So, you know, I was listening to a podcast years ago, and they were talking about how Shai Hulud went on tour with Strong Arm, and, you know, there were people that were, there was one venue that didn't want Strong Arm to play because they were a faith-based Christian hardcore band. Being, you know, in that scene of, you know, hardcore and stuff, did you guys ever experience, you know, some pushback from, you know, the more punk or DIY places that didn't want, you know, a tooth and nail band?
Yeah. I would say Focal Point sort of got a little bit more of it because that was even earlier.
Yeah.
And so within the hardcore scenes, straight edge scenes, it was more... it was more the fan base than anything else. But we would play shows where we would, you know, we'd go two songs in and we would just get in a fist fight on stage.
Oh, wow.
You know? Bands would unplug our gear. But we were sort of scrappy as well. So, like, we would, you know, we would throw elbows and we would also also unplug gear and stuff like that. And then training, by the time training came around, I mean, we sort of sat on the fence about a lot of that stuff as well, and our lyrics weren't overtly spiritual whatsoever.
But we had the logo on the back of the record.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was enough for a lot of people, you know, bands that we would play with or whatever. Like, we would play shows with bands and sort of get the cold shoulder, you know.
But, you know, what's funny is they were always cool over our CD.
You're a TNN band.
But I think it was mainly, we had some issues in Berkeley, like, early on, but at the Gilman, I mean, that's kind of, but I don't remember really much of it.
We didn't have much of it. Focal Point had a lot of, like, heckling from the crowd and stuff like that, people throwing stuff. By the time TFU came around, it was just, like, I think it was less of a hard, like, a stereotypical hardcore kid.
Right.
Yeah. And more of, like, a kind of grimy, like, San Francisco, like, squattery kind of fan. And I don't even know if they knew what to make of the labels, you know? Right. Like, hardcore kids paid more attention to that kind of stuff.
Our friends in Frotis signed a Tooth and Nail, you know, like...
They were not even Christian
band. Not even Christian band.
All.
I remember
they
Nate's one of my closest friends, and he's like, we had no idea that we would get, like, anyone saying anything. We just signed to this label. We didn't even know.
Yeah.
And so they got stuff, because they're from D.C., they got stuff kind of from similar, not a ton, but from their scene, and they just didn't see it coming. Whereas, like, because
they're
of Focal
like,
Point...
They just signed to a label.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
With Focal Point, I knew that that had happened and kind of like, okay, this could happen with TFU. But yeah, who would have known that, like, you know, some of the biggest hardcore bands would be faith-based now?
I mean, look, it's interesting when I talk with Jeff Suffering from 90 Pound Wuss, he was saying that they went through a similar thing, and that's why he said 90 Pound Wuss ended up breaking up, because they wanted to continue on with the sound that they were doing, but a lot of it had to do with, like, he didn't think that he said that they were tainted by the Tooth and Nail, that, like, you know, that a label, like a different indie label wouldn't want to sign him, so they just, you know, broke up and he started his own things. But so it's interesting that you know, a couple of years later, Under Oath, you know, blows up, and then, you know, so many of these different bands, Azalea Dying and whatnot, you know, become these humongous names, and now there's not really a stigma.
It was really short-lived, the whole, you know, that whole kind of backlash, that era that Focal Point was, when that was happening, it was like focused, you know, down in Southern California, Unashamed, Overcome in Arizona,
Strong Arm
in Florida, Zayo in West Virginia. It was
Living Sacrifice.
But they were in the metal scene where, you know, dudes just wanted to show up and headbang.
Yeah.
I don't know how
much
they
matter that much.
Yeah. I don't know how much they got, because hardcore kids were so serious about the message,
reading the lyrics.
Like And so that was, you know, back at those shows, there was, like, there were bands, and then there were people selling vegan zines and, like, all this kind of the peripheral hardcore stuff. So it's like that stuff was just as important like the music and stuff.
Or as metal.
It wasn't like that at all. It was like, oh, they're heavy. They're that's it.
Yeah, they have long hair. Yeah. Cool.
So I know Bruce really well. I should talk to him and see how much of that sort of backlash they did get. But I haven't really heard about that. And it was, you know, mid-90s, right up until about like 99, it seemed like that was when it was the worst.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, by the time like Under Oath and you know, even just, because I know it wasn't just relegated to hardcore alone, but you had like all these bands that were starting to sort of break at that time, like that were Tooth and Nail bands and stuff.
And I will say like 95% of, you know, the hardcore scene was awesome, you know, and just be like, let these guys do whatever they want. And it was, like, for the most part, very like open scene and stuff. But there would always, you know, there was like the bad eggs or whatever. But,
yeah, and that's the other part that was so rad about the hardcore scene that is so today was this understanding that you could come to the table with whatever belief you had and whatever sort of life, you know, like worldview that you had, and if you had the wherewithal to form a band and write the songs and play the songs and book the shows and end up on stage, then you earned the right to be there.
Yeah.
And that was all that it took, right? You had to play some part in it. Mm-hmm. You had to either have a zine or have a little distro table at the
show. Do a college radio show or whatever it was. Yeah.
But as long as you were a part of the scene and you were contributing, you were given
it didn't matter what
a piece of the pie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of shut up and let them say what they're going to say. Mm-hmm. When you want to start a band and be up there, you can do that, and we'll let you do the same thing. And that's like that's missing in general, like from just discourse
society
today, right? And hardcore is almost like this time capsule of like, look, it's possible. Like you can actually do it. You can like.
Disagree and be homies
with people. Like it works, you know.
I will say that, and I'm going to get off this topic, but I will say that it is funny hearing you guys talk about this when, you know, you'd be getting crap for being a quote unquote religious on a religious label where, you know, a good portion of the bigger bands in the hardcore scene were then bringing Hare Krishna into those rooms, you know, how funny is it that, you know, they'll accept one religion, but the other one is, you know, so.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. But I think that's part of why there was an underbelly of acceptance, though, is because it wasn't just Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where, like in metal, it's kind of like you're either a Christian band or you're just a metal band.
Yeah.
You know, like in hardcore, it was like there were Baha'i, there were Buddhists, there were, you know, there was all sorts of bands sort of doing their thing.
Absolutely.
And so because of that, it sort of created this, you know, foundation of like,
straight edge.
There's space for all those things.
Yep. There's all these little, you know, compartmentalized
micro genres, micro scenes.
It was great. Yeah.
And now you have Furnace Fest where, you know, Hatebreed and MXPX can play together and Demon Hunter and Training for Utopia and then, you know, Turnstile and Dying Wish and all these different kind of bands can come together. So,
well, I never thought that TFU would play with Youth of Today. So I'm ecstatic.
That's awesome, dude. Hey, there you go. Yeah. The old Krishna and the, you know, that's awesome. So, okay. So Training for Utopia, is there any chance, and I have to do it. Is there any chance of a new song ever down the road?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably as good a place to talk about it as any. I will say this all hinges on the fact or on the, on, you know, whether or not we can pull it off because we haven't as a band played the song yet. But there is a song written and demo recorded and, you know, all that for a new song, which we'll see the light of day at some point, but we are also planning on playing it live. So, there's a new song called Out on Parole.
Yeah.
And there's a handful of other songs that when this whole thing sort of became a reality, I happened to have some time and I was just in Demoville in my head. And so I was just every day I was like going for it.
Yeah.
So there's a handful of songs and there's a handful more of ideas. And so I don't know what's going to come of that in the future. At the very least, we've got this one song that we'll see the light of day. But who knows? Maybe more than that.
That's amazing. And your son's going to be able to see you play in Training for Utopia.
Yes, I'm super stoked. Yeah, yeah. My son, Cash, 17, he's a huge music fan. And I'm, you know, as he loves all the stuff that I love. And so I'm on, you know, I'm on cloud nine.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What was his, you know, kind of foray? Was it the Metallicas and the AC/DCs, or did
What's cool is that I never saw it coming. I didn't think that he'd get into music, you know.
Yeah.
And it
you weren't the pushy dad.
No, I wasn't. I mean, we had, you know, his uncle was in a metal band, and so like he was around it, but I wasn't. When I kind of left the band, I really left the band.
Yeah.
I was focused on my career and having kids and, you know, a family. So he has a really good buddy that's also into music, and
nice.
They kind of just like got into it together. And then, you know, it was almost like, oh, yeah, my dad was in bands, you know, like,
yeah.
So, you know, I think like he's
like, damn right, son.
Yeah, exactly. But he got into like Havoc and Metallica,
nice.
And, you know, he's better than I am in terms of a guitar player. He is, yeah, he's worked his butt off this last year, and he's getting really good. But yeah, I would say he's more into like guitar gods and
okay.
guys that like are really
yeah.
like talented. Whereas I just wanted to pick up a guitar and bang on it and go tour like that. That was
mm-hmm. We got a young Michael Schenker on
yeah.
our hands.
Well, I told him like if you want to, it was early on. Now he's you know much better. But I told him like. Learn how to play the right way so you can play the wrong way.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, and like all these guys, Mustaine and Zach Wild, you know, they never took lessons. They just figured it out. And they're some of the best, you know, and that's what he's done, you know. And
that's cool.
Yeah, super cool. I'm, like I said, living the, you know, having the time of my life with him, getting into all these bands. And what's cool is all these bands are still playing for the most part.
Oh,
we've seen Quicksand a couple times. We saw Helmet. We went to Furnace Fest, obviously saw a bunch of bands, but we've been to like 50 shows in the last year and a half, and cool. And
he'll even have a chance to see Pantera.
Exactly. We have tickets actually. Yes. I have, you know, I've never seen Metallica. So when those tickets came up, I was like, these guys are going to be 61 years old. Yep. I think we have to do it.
Yeah,
so.
I got to do it now.
Forget the mortgage for a week.
Yeah, no. So yeah, $1,500 for three tickets.
There we go. All right.
And, oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm like, all right.
All right. Let's
go. It's well worth it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. So you guys are now, I guess, like you guys are at least a northwest portion of the band. And so this is obviously a local show. What are some of your favorite northwest bands, you know, of all time?
I'm going to go first because he's going to steal all. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to say the same bands.
I'm going to say the same ones.
No.
Go ahead.
From a hardcore standpoint, obviously Botch, Undertow, Kiss and Goodbye.
Undertow just played the Indecision 30-year anniversary.
Yes, I heard about
dude.
That.
I watched videos. I was like...
Kiss and Goodbye is probably my favorite hardcore band from here. Foo Fighters, Alice in Chains. I mean, you know, Foo Fighters would technically, I think, back then be considered a Seattle band.
Well, Dave Grohl wrote the whole first thing.
Yeah, here
and
yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to say Foo Fighters.
Totally.
Okay. Yeah. I almost forgot about Kiss of Goodbye. I love it. I love Kiss of Goodbye. I would say, like, generally speaking, and from a really young age, Alice in Chains by a long shot.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here wearing a Pearl Jam shirt.
Yeah.
I kind of... like a lot of people probably my age, kind of really just like the early Pearl Jam stuff. As a band like Alice in Chains, I consistently like what they do. And I would say on a more niche level, Black Breath was, you know,
R.I.P.
just my
Elijah, man.
Yeah, I know. When they were around, I mean, I basically went to every local show.
Good. Have you heard Neil's new band? Vacuum?
I have not.
Yeah, dude.
I'm sure it's good.
He's still got that. He is the best voice.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing.
He has a new kind of like punkish DB, but still. I saw him play at Capitol Hill Block Party down at the Cha-Cha.
Rad.
And Vacuum. Check him
That's
out.
That's a great name.
Yeah.
That is I can't believe it's not taken.
Right?
Yeah, they were that band where... they could set up like in a living room or they could play Numos and it would always sound so good, like no matter where. And they were so tight. It was like you look at them and it looks like they're barely holding on, but it's perfect. It was just perfect every single time. And I've you can hardly ever find any other band that, that nailed it like they did. I wish everyone would have got to see them. But yeah, they were my favorite. Me and my wife would go to basically every show that they played.
Amazing.
Even if it was 100 miles in any direction.
So. Oh, that's awesome. Black Breath, some Alice in Chains, some Pearl Jam. We got some under... Okay, that's awesome. Yeah. Guys, right on. Well, thank you so much for coming up, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks you so much.
It's been rad to talk to you guys. I kind of just threw this idea out there. Didn't know if you guys would be down to talk, but I'm so thankful that you could talk about this because, again, they're going to be playing Friday, September 15th. This is their first show in 23 years.
23-ish, yeah.
With Eris at El Corazon. And Eris, if you're not familiar, that's John from Undertow's band, incredible band. You can catch them Friday, September 15th. Tickets are available now. They're also going to be playing Furnace Fest, going to be playing in, what's the venue in Portland?
Hawthorne Theater on the 17th, Sunday the 17th of September.
Right on. And any final words for the Northwest audience for Metal Shop before we go?
Tickets are not sold out.
Okay.
So come on out. We want to see you guys.
It'll be fun. It'll be a good show, and it'll be a lot of fun. And we got outfits.
Okay.
Just give us some grace. We have no idea what's going to happen, but we're excited.
Nice. All right. Well, Training for Utopia. We're going to go into a final song here, A Good Feeling. Anything you guys want to say about this one?
This was our first, after we had basically got signed off of the EP, this was our first thing, like, actually on a label, on a full-length record, first song of that record. I had heard, like, that sort of emergency broadcast beep thing at some point, and I was like, it would be cool to start a song with sort of a feedbacky kind of, and then actually say the words, "This is only a test," and sort of, like, meld them into the lyric somehow. And I don't know if it had ever been done prior to that. I feel kind of proud that we were the ones to do the "This is only a test" beat.
We did it.
Kind of make that a song. So
nice. Well, it's A Good Feeling. Training for Utopia again Friday, September 15th at El Corazon. It's Metal Shop here on The Rock.
This is only a test.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.